Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Asaf Ghaffouri, professor of computer science at Boston University, who assesses the growing risk of regional war after Iran's massive retaliatory attack against Israel for Israel's earlier bombing of its Syrian embassy. Independent journalist Julie Dermansky, who examines the collapse of media coverage of the Marathon Petroleum Refinery fire in Louisiana last year that left residents struggling to assess the potential impacts to their health. And Katie Hirschenroder, a fellow at Mother Jones Magazine, who discusses Arizona's Supreme Court ruling that imposes an oppressive 160-year-old abortion ban and the local and national impact ahead of the 2024 election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A series of confrontations between Chinese and Philippine ships in the South China Sea risk a wider conflict. The most recent flashpoint involved a World War II-era ship, the Sierra Madre, that the Philippines deliberately grounded on the disputed Second Thomas Shoal in 1999, a submerged reef in the Spratly Islands, which now serves as an active outpost. On March 23rd, China used a water cannon against a Philippine boat on a resupply mission to Filipino sailors deployed on the Sierra Madre, the Spratly Islands sit between the Philippines, Vietnam, and Malaysia. The islands and reefs there are the subject of many overlapping territorial claims. Although they have little value in themselves, the islands sit on a critical trade and supply route. China claims 90% of the South China Sea as its sovereign territory, but that claim is disputed by five Southeast Asian states and Taiwan. Reuters reports that there's growing concern that a maritime incident could escalate into a major military confrontation between China and the United States, which recently ran military exercises in Southeast Asia with Japan and the Philippines. Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs explained that her veto of a bipartisan affordable housing bill was due to objections from the U.S. military and other powerful interests. The Arizona Starter Homes Act proposed to ease the housing crunch and would have prevented cities with over 70,000 residents from using restrictive zoning laws to stop construction of houses for first-time buyers. The Atlantic magazine reports that a few days before the veto, Rear Admiral Brad Rosen sent Governor Hobbs a letter citing broad concerns that the bipartisan legislation might fail to protect areas near military installations. The Pentagon worries that increasing population density and new buildings near its bases could interfere with pilot training operations and live fire and nighttime training exercises. But the Pentagon's concerns contradict President Joe Biden's opposition to local zoning restrictions that have contributed to America's shortage of affordable housing and support for bills like the vetoed Arizona Starter Homes Act. A lobbyist for progressive Arizona nonprofits who worked for passage of the housing bill said she was blindsided by the Pentagon's objections. Representative Leo Biasucci, the bill's Republican sponsor, told The Atlantic that had Arizona lawmakers known about the military's concern, they could have sought a compromise that still would have addressed the affordable housing crisis. Access to safe legal abortion is on the ballot in Florida this November, where voters can support a state constitutional amendment that would overturn an oppressive 6-week abortion ban advocated by the state's right-wing Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, and embraced by Florida's extremist GOP legislature and state Supreme Court. During the 2022 midterm election, DeSantis and Republican Senator Marco Rubio easily won re-election. Republicans have maintained control of both houses of Florida's legislature for 20 years, while the Democratic Party has underinvested in Florida campaigns in favor of major funding in swing states like Georgia and Arizona. The American Prospect reports Florida Democrats who won recent surprise victories in an Orlando State House election and the mayor's race in Jacksonville are hopeful that November's abortion referendum will re-energize the party. Pro-choice activists collected over 1.5 million petition signatures to get the Reproductive Rights Amendment on the ballot, overcoming objections from Republican State Attorney General Ashley Moody. 60% of Florida voters must approve the state constitutional amendment for it to become law. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
On April 13th, Iran launched an unprecedented retaliatory attack on Israel that included more than 300 missiles and drones from Iran itself and Iran-backed groups in several nations. Virtually all missiles fired at Israel were intercepted and destroyed by Israeli air defense systems, as well as forces activated by the U.S., Jordan, and France. Israel reported there was very little damage from the air assault. Iran's attack came in response to the April 1st Israeli bombing of the Iranian embassy compound in the Syrian capital of Damascus that killed 7 Iranian military officers, including 2 high-ranking generals. The missile and drone attack marked the first time Iran has launched a direct military assault on Israel during a decades-long shadow war between the two nations. Although Iran issued a statement after their attack that they considered the matter concluded unless Israel retaliated, Israeli Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant vowed there would be a response to Iran's offensive. But the Biden administration and several other Western nations allied with Israel have urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to rush into a retaliation against Iran that could trigger a regional war, with U.S. officials warning that America will not participate in any offensive action against Iran. Your reporter spoke with Asaf Kafouri, professor of computer science at Boston University, who assesses the growing risk of a dangerous regional war that has for the moment distracted much of the world from Israel's mass slaughter of Palestinian civilians in Gaza and the onset of widespread famine there.
Netanyahu and his government are facing a crisis in Gaza itself. It's not going as fast as they promised it's going to be. And what they needed to do with what they've done in Damascus is a way of mobilizing the United States and Europe too on their side in a bigger confrontation with Iran. They would like, and they haven't succeeded very well, but they would like to get the United States on their side openly in confronting Iran, under the assumption, which is the wrong assumption also, that Iran is the one that is providing the guns and the weapons and the support that Hamas needs to pursue its resistance. We know now that Hamas made its decision on October 7 without notifying Iran or their allies like Hezbollah in Lebanon. A little to their surprise. I mean, we know this from some other reports that people have given. So even though they are supported by Iran, they have some kind of relative independence in their decision-making. And they went ahead and did whatever they did. Okay, it was horrific, but they did it on October 7. Now, that campaign that was started around the middle of October by the Israeli state and with the army has not gone as promised. I mean, they destroyed Gaza. Gaza is completely obliterated. But the idea that they will finish off Hamas within 2 months or 3 months, this hasn't happened. And now the United States is a bit in a bind because Israel is seen as a rogue state by the rest of the world. The United States, okay, it can continue to veto a resolution in the Security Council. But nevertheless, Netanyahu is putting the United States in a corner. Mr. Biden is telling Netanyahu, listen, consider what has happened with our help. We have shot down 90% of the missiles and the drones. Consider it a victory and call it off, done. Okay, and Iranian basically said, look, we consider the matter closed if you stop here. But where Mr. Netanyahu and his cabinet coming from, that did what they did, and we know now, not notifying the United States, they're going to launch this attack on the consulate in Damascus in order to mobilize, in order to get the United States directly involved with them. They tried, Mr. Netanyahu tried more than once in the past, if you remember, to get the United States to go directly against Iran.
Well, Professor Kafouri, we only have a few minutes left, but Israel's attack on Iran's embassy compound in Damascus, Syria, seemed designed to distract the world from the carnage in Gaza, and especially the deaths of the 7 humanitarian aid workers of the World Central Kitchen killed by Israeli fire. If that's what the objective was, or part of the objective was, along with trying to get the United States tangled up in a possible conflict with Iran, extremely dangerous as it is, they at least temporarily did distract the world from the continued carnage and bloodshed in Gaza. According to many Israeli commentators, newspapers, and news coverage, it's well known that Netanyahu has an advantage of keeping this war going as long as possible to avoid an election that he will likely lose. He does face a corruption trial and possible prison. So this has a lot of consequences for him personally.
You're perfectly right. You put all the pieces together here. I mean, and you can see from that angle, he's gambling, and he's gambling in a way that is dangerous for everybody. Number one, as you point out, he's deflecting attention from the destruction of Gaza, from what happened with the 7 aid workers. He's distracting from the fact that he did not achieve what he promised he will achieve within 2-3 months or whatever. We are 6 months into that campaign. There's nothing else he can destroy in Gaza. I mean, there is Rafah, the town in the south of the Gaza Strip. And then if there's an election he's going to lose, if he doesn't come back and say we have won, and then he loses the election, or he's going to be sued for corruption, well, the man is trying to save himself or his political career or whatever, and he does what he did with the destruction of the consulate. So, yeah, you have it there, exactly the scenario that is going through. And, of course, it's very dangerous because to survive politically, he's doing something that is going to be very, very dangerous for the whole region.
That was Asaf Kafouri, professor of computer science at Boston University. Find a link to his recent article on Israel's divide-and-rule strategy that's guided their decades-long relationship with Hamas by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 9th, Norfolk Southern, the railroad responsible for the February 2023 train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, settled a class-action lawsuit for $600 million. The train was carrying 700,000 pounds of toxic vinyl chloride, which rail officials, fearing an explosion, set on fire, sending up huge plumes of black smoke. In the settlement, Norfolk Southern didn't admit liability or fault. The East Palestine train derailment received widespread news coverage that brought intense scrutiny from government regulators and Congress. In addition to the announced settlement, over the past year, the railroad made $100 million in payments to the town and residents impacted by the chemical fire. The management of the train derailment in East Palestine stands in stark contrast with how another industrial accident in Louisiana was handled. In August 2023, 6 months after the East Palestine incident, a chemical release and fire at the Marathon Petroleum Company's refinery in St. John the Baptist Parish led to a mandatory evacuation for several hours before local residents were given the all clear to return. There's been almost no media coverage of the fire beyond the initial incident. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Julie Dormansky, an independent multimedia journalist who lives in the New Orleans area. She covered the Marathon refinery fire, but also continued investigating the accident long after the rest of the media left the scene. Here she describes what was learned about the industrial accident by sticking with the story.
There was a what they call a pollution incident at the Marathon refinery. I looked at the exclusion zone because, you know, there was a shelter in place and then an evacuation. And so I made sure to go where I wouldn't have to fight to get in so I could get some images as fast as possible, which is kind of funny in this case because it's part of the story. I could have just driven right to the place and they never closed off the area. So a lot of community members that were, let's say, you know, a mile or less in this one neighborhood that's close by didn't even know. So, you know, the black smoke was going everywhere. And as you often hear in pollution incidents, you're told, oh, nothing to see here. You know, it's all contained within the facility and there's no danger to the public, right? So later that afternoon, the incident was under control and all the media left. And, you know, but like usual, I just went on covering it. And that's when things get interesting because the incident was on a Friday and a lot of the public doesn't realize we barely as a society have media on the weekend anymore because no one wants to pay and, you know, the stations can get away with the skeleton crew. So no one was really paying attention. Well, I got a tip from someone about a live stream on Facebook that the fire had restarted. You know, so I see this clip and this worker is holding his cell phone and he's like, oh my God, you know, and look at this and what are we doing here? And I'm like, is this real? And it was from 9 o'clock and it was about 11. So I contacted the number, the help number on the sheriff's site to see if the fire was still going because I didn't necessarily want to drive out there for something that wasn't real. And they wouldn't tell me anything. And then I come to realize the number I had called was actually for a company that was handling the press and media for the company, which is, you know, if you think about it, that's kind of messed up. So on the sheriff's website, you call a number thinking you're getting local help and you're actually getting a representative from the company. So I went out there and, you know, the flames that I had seen in the video that were there that morning, which were real, had gotten under control, but it was still smoking and whatever. But I drove right up to as close as I could to that tank. And the video that I'll give you a show, you know, was smoking and the chemicals were really bad. Anyway, the stories that we come across, you think they're over because there's kind of a footnote from the media and they all pick up and go, but they keep going. And that, again, that's when it gets interesting. So I went the next day as well, you know, just I wanted to see what was going on, if it was really out, because there was nowhere to get the news. And the second day on Sunday, they did finally get the smoke out completely, but that's when things got interesting. I saw different people on the ground and I just took pictures of all of the cars and their logos. And I found that one of the groups of people there were actually the same cleanup crew that were on the ground after the Ohio incident in Palestine, where the train, you know, derailed and all the chemicals. And, you know, if I hadn't gone back, I would never have known that.
It was interesting you mentioned East Palestine because, you know, there were a lot of chemicals that were released that, yeah, again, it was sort of the same thing. Well, nothing to see here. Nobody's in danger, but the people who are living there are living with definite impacts to their health. So how did that play out down in Louisiana?
No one will ever really know what they had to breathe in because nobody monitored it. The state government can easily say, oh, well, there were no dangerous toxins because they don't necessarily monitor for what they were. And so getting the information, you really, really have to press to get it. I don't think people realize that if they don't take matters into their own hands, like the people learned in East Palestine, you know, we don't get what we need necessarily. And people in Louisiana did not get what they needed. The biggest information and news around this story was when can the Marathon refinery remain operational? And most of it never really shut down because, you know, God forbid business, anything connected to oil and gas closes down. So, you know, we have to keep it running. So, you know, there's an undertone of that when you're covering these things, but the community members really never got the information of what they breathed in and if it was safe and if the chemicals penetrated their homes the way they did in Ohio.
That was independent multimedia journalist Julie Dermansky. Learn more about the long-term effects of the Marathon fire and find links to Dermansky's reporting on the industrial accident by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 9th, Arizona State Supreme Court handed down a ruling that dredged up and imposed an 1864 law banning abortion in almost all cases that makes abortion a felony, punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison for anyone who performs one or helps a woman obtain one. The 160-year-old law that was enacted 50 years before Arizona gained statehood outlaws abortion from the moment of conception, but includes an exception to save the life of the mother. The Arizona ruling came just 2 days after former President Donald Trump said states should make their own decisions about regulating abortion in an attempt to justify his central role in the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade that eliminated federal constitutional protection for access to abortion. 1 day after the Arizona Supreme Court reinstated the 1864 abortion ban, the state's Republican legislators blocked multiple attempts by Democrats to repeal the law. But Arizona voters will likely have the final say, as abortion rights advocates have gathered more than 500,000 signatures to put a constitutional amendment on the November ballot that would protect abortion until fetal viability at around 22 to 24 weeks. Your reporter spoke with Katie Hirschenroeder, a fellow at Mother Jones Magazine, who discusses how Arizona's imposition of the 1864 abortion law will impact the lives of people and health providers in the state and the national political debate ahead of this November's presidential election.
So I lived in Arizona between the ages of 9 and 18, and I still have immediate family there. I have friends, childhood friends. You know, I received both texts being really confused, saying, what does this mean for my friend? What does this mean for me? What does this mean for my family? And then I also just received a lot of anger on social media from people seeing this reporting that I've been doing, and anger that this is happening, and also disbelief that something from 160 years ago could apply to their lives today.
Katie, this November, it's expected that enough petition signatures will be collected by pro-choice activists to hold a statewide referendum that could overturn the 1864 abortion ban. What's the status of that effort now? And do you expect that voters will support abortion rights in November?
So a little over a week ago, a coalition of groups across Arizona announced that they were able to secure enough signatures to include this constitutional amendment on the ballot. It would create a quote-unquote fundamental right to abortion up to the 24th week, and it could go beyond that to, quote, protect the life or the physical or mental health of the pregnant person. And this is especially important because, as compared to other life of the mother exceptions, this also includes mental health, which is just a broader protection. A little bit of context there. Similar statewide ballot measures have succeeded with voters in California, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan, Montana, Ohio, and Vermont. And so we've seen across the country, in response to the Dobbs decision, that this is a real avenue that voters are using to have their voice heard on abortion access and reproductive justice. In Arizona specifically, during the 2022 midterms, the majority, 6 out of 10 Arizona voters, said that they were in favor of guaranteeing legal abortion nationwide. So it's tough to know, but in the context of the backlash that I've been hearing about this 1864 ruling, people are angry and people are wanting their voices to be heard. So I at minimum, I expect a close vote on that ballot measure.
Katie, what's your view of the media coverage of this issue across the country? We have Donald Trump trying to muddy the waters and really attempt to convince voters
that he's not responsible for these draconian abortion laws, which he clearly is and took credit for on many occasions. And you also have many state legislators, you have congressional candidates and Senate candidates who continually try to walk a fine line and not take a position on their anti-abortion votes that they've cast many times in their state or federal legislature. Is the media properly holding these people to account for their schizophrenic rhetoric that they spout as the election approaches?
I'd say two things. One, I think that local Arizona media, namely the Arizona Mirror and the Arizona Republic, have been doing just incredible reporting on holding these members of government to account. They consistently do great reporting on local Republican candidates who have, as we've been talking about, switched their tone. And so I think that that's very, very commendable. I think that nationally, I think that the media at large can still be wise to keep context to the things that Donald Trump says about abortion. I think that that spreads to headlines and leads. So instead of saying just that Donald Trump says he will not support a national abortion ban or a headline that says, you know, Donald Trump thinks Arizona went too far, I think that it's our responsibility on the national stage to put those comments in context. My colleague, Julianne, has done a great job of this, of saying, well, Trump says that he's not going to pass a national abortion ban days after he took credit for ending Roe v. Wade. And I think putting those two things in the same sentence is immensely important for readers to know.
That was Katie Hirschenroder, a reporter and fellow with Mother Jones Magazine. Find links to her recent articles on Arizona's 1864 abortion law and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KIDE in Hoopa, California, REC Delmarva FM nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.